Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hi, this is Josh Levine, and this is Slate's sports podcast, Hang Up and Listen, for the week of June 18th, 2018. On this week's show, we'll be joined by Slate's Nick Green to talk about the opening week of the World Cup, wherein Argentina, Germany, and Brazil all came away without victories. Fox Sports sent some people to Russia and left others behind to call games from a studio. An instant replay, well, instant replay exists, for better or for worse. Our colleague Jim Newell will also be here to talk about Brooks Koepka's back-to-back wins at golf's U.S. Open and the awesome spectacle of the game's greatest players complaining that the sport they play is too hard. And finally, we'll complete our delicious soccer-golf-soccer sandwich by interviewing Ken Bensinger about his new book, Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. Joining me in Slate's Washington, D.C. studio this week is Stefan Fatsis, the author of the books Word Freak and A Few Seconds of Panic. And why do you even need to be in the World Cup, Stefan, if you can blow the whistle on the world's biggest sports scandal? That's the greatest victory of all.
We win. USA.
Raise the banner.
Wins the World Cup.
Before we get started, Stefan, I want to thank TiddlyWinks239 for the five-star review on iTunes. Review title, best podcast ever. Review text, love you guys. I love TiddlyWinks239 too, way more than the other TiddlyWinkses. At this point,
137, pretty good TiddlyWinks.
I think I'm going to stop begging for five-star reviews at this point. But, although if you want to give us a five-star review, well, I would not be upset.
I figure if you haven't given us a five-star review yet, just give us a four-star review.
Oh, no.
This is for all the four-star people out there that don't want to give us five.
No.
Really? It's five or nothing with you, Josh?
Yes, five-star reviews.
All right.
But thanks to everyone who's helped us out so far. It'll help more listeners discover the show, which is a very good thing for us. Don't ever listen to Stefan is my advice before we start this episode. On Sunday in Moscow, Mexico and Germany were scoreless in the first half of their World Cup clash when this happened. Guardado que devuelve para Javier. Pachicharo se cruza. Tachuki viene primero. Viene. Engancha para pegarle. Viene. Gol. Impressive range and control from Andres Cantor of Telemundo, even by Andres Cantor standards. The goal would hold up for Mexico. They beat the defending World Cup champs 1-0 in what may have been the greatest victory in the history of the Mexican men's national team. That was not the only surprising result in the first 4 days of the World Cup. Iceland got a draw with Lionel Messi's Argentina. Switzerland also managed to draw Neymar and Brazil. And those weren't the only great games either. Spain 3, Portugal 3, with Ronaldo scoring a hat trick. That was not bad either. Joining us now to discuss the World Cup is Nick Green, who's a contributing writer for Slate. Nick, hello. The World Cup?
Hi.
The World Cup, it's good, Nick.
It's good. It's very good. I'm enjoying it.
Except for Morocco, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Russia. Those were not good.
Those had their moments. As in, they were moments that transpired and were broadcast, and we watched them. So they had their moments.
So one of the pieces that you wrote over the weekend, Nick, was trying to figure out how many O's go in a goal like Chucky Lozano's historic goal for Mexico. Can you kind of walk us through the process there?
Yeah, well, for that goal, watched it again and put the closed captioning on. and saw how many O's the goal call received via the closed caption service on Twitter and over the air on Telemundo, and that got 54 O's. Mm-hmm. So it was a good goal. It was a great goal.
Yeah, I kind of dispute your methodology, though. I think relying on the closed caption person might not be the best way to approach this. I think this.
Yeah, do the job yourself.
This is a math problem, Nick. This is solvable.
It's objective.
Do you have a stopwatch?
The data is sound.
Someone put
the
a stopwatch on.
The data is sound.
No.
The process is pure. It was 54 O's. If you dispute that, I think we can consult VAR on this, but I think I'm correct, and the goal stands.
All right, I'm going to put a stopwatch on, and then I'm going to count. I'm just going to say O for five seconds, and then we will do the math based on how long Contour held his O.
Nick already timed it. What was the time?
He timed the length, but he didn't time how many O's per second.
It was 13.1 seconds, I believe, the first goal call he gave, which I think he was holding back because it was only the 35th minute, mm-hmm. and he probably assumed Germany would equalize. So he didn't want to kind of go all out on the goal on that first one, but it was pretty nice.
That's two O's per second.
That's 2 hours per second, but I'm gonna turn on my stopwatch. I'm just going to go, what's a good speed here? Oh, is that too fast?
That's perfect.
Okay, ready? Here we go. Oh.
I think that was 18 O's, Stefan.
In 5 seconds. So in 15 seconds, that would be 18 times 3.
I think it was 13 seconds.
I know. So 54 in 15 seconds. So in 13 seconds, it would be slightly fewer O's.
18 times 13 divided by 5 is 46.8. All right, Nick. So we got 47 for the first goal call, and then I was like listed twice on the screen. So does that mean that it should be 47 times 2, 94 O's instead of 54 O's?
Well, it's a little confusing because the goal just kind of stayed on the screen. I think the person got sick of typing it over again, so it just stayed on the screen there. So I think 54 is basically as much as you're ever going to get.
And I'm comfortable. I think that's within the margin of error, 54, 47.
Okay. Well,
good job, closed captioner.
I mean, the methods that we used were just like totally sound and scientifically rigorous. Yeah. And so I'm confident that we have the correct answer here. Stefan, this was a really surprising result. Mexico, not a team you're particularly fond of, given their rivalry with the United States of America. What did you make of that game?
What I make of a lot of games that I see Mexico play against sort of top six teams in the world is that they tend to rise to the occasion. They look like they belong among the top teams.
The top Mannschafts?
With the Mannschafts, yes. And, you know, when we play, we being the United States, when we play Germany, we don't look like we belong on the pitch most of the time. Mexico looked like they belonged in that game yesterday.
We belong on the field, but not the pitch.
And I don't know what that says about Mexico, if it says something about the United States, but
Mexico
looked like a team that it should be advancing to the quarterfinals of this tournament, at least.
The negative view of that, Nick, would be that Mexico is a perennial underachiever.
Yes.
If we want to
that too.
If we want to rag on Mexico a bit.
Perennial, maybe. This year, I think I kind of disagree. I think they look good. They could have won 2 or 3-0. There's room for improvement.
That doesn't mean they underachieved. If they could have won 2 or 3-0 and they won 1-0.
I guess that just means they did. Yeah, so they are underachievers. They underachieved again. Mexico, I can't believe it. But I think it says more about Germany than it does Mexico. They looked kind of out of sorts. And other chances were clear cut. And it looks like they really miss Bastian Schweinsteiger and Philipp Lahm, kind of their old guard. It's still early. It's probably a good thing for the tournament on a whole for the teams like Germany and Argentina not to get results early on because it means they'll actually have something to play for come the third game of the group tournament, of the group stages. So it'll be very interesting to see how they respond. But good for Mexico.
Well, good for Mexico. Germany is in full meltdown already. The Guardian's headline this morning is media commentators draw parallels with Angela Merkel's struggle to keep the coalition government together, which I think is
that's
a plausible
the first thing I
analysis.
Thought,
that's exactly what I thought. And Germany, and this is an ESPN headline, Germany cancel World Cup media activity after Mexico loss as paper slams wimps. I'm making air quotes around wimps. They called off all media activities on Monday. Philip Lahm was supposed to give a news conference for Germany's bid for the 2024 Euros. That was called off.
And love a good meltdown.
The National Mannschaft. They're going to train behind closed doors on Monday. I think Schweinsteiger not being there is my biggest disappointment because I love screaming Schweinsteiger at the screen when he comes on.
So. Who's saying you can't do that?
I did it anyway during the Mexico game because I realized that I knew he wasn't playing.
This makes me hope that Germany loses every game. It's so funny.
Well, Spain lost its first game in 2010 and won the World Cup. It's good to have a little overreaction here. I think Germany will probably be okay. That's my prediction.
Philip Lahm, to be fair, the ESPN story notes that he did speak later on Monday.
We were all wondering.
During a visit to a German school, he took questions only from school children, not from journalists.
The school children are all like, what the fuck is wrong with the Mannschaft, Philip?
I would love like a newspaper to have their youngest looking reporter go undercover as a school child to ask him about the 2024 bid for the Euros.
Landon Donovan has come out and said that Americans should support Mexico in the tournament. USA fans, our team may not be in Russia, but our neighbors to the south are. So join me and their proud hashtag sponsor, Wells Fargo, to cheer on our other team, Mexico. Vamos, Mexico. Landon Donovan, Mexican shill for pay. And then things got a little bit off the rails, like his former national team teammates, including Carlos Bocanegra, responded, really? And then Donovan wrote back to Bocanegra, you grew up in SoCal and owe much of your soccer skill to playing with Mexicans. Your father is of Mexican descent. Look around our country. Are you happy with how we are treating Mexicans? Open your mind, stand for something, and remember where you came from.
I just want to add that after your father is of Mexican descent, he does parentheses facepalm emoji.
Yeah, that's a good emoji on multiple levels.
Listeners know that I've been in the bag for Donovan for many years, but Landon, man, this was not a good take. I don't know what Wells Fargo was paying him. And look, Landon played this spring in Mexico, came out of retirement. He has always made it clear that he supports Mexican culture and Mexican football. But on the other hand, you know, Mexican fans throw like urine on American players, or used to, maybe not anymore. And this is our biggest rival. This is a huge rivalry. And I understand the sentiment. I mean, look, more soccer fans go to watch the Mexican national team play in the United States than watch the U.S. national team play in the United States very often. I mean, there's a reason that for a lot of money, Mexican national team games, friendlies are played here because there's a huge audience. I mean, that doesn't mean that everyone in the United States needs to support Mexico.
Well, this is just a weird situation because I am also extremely sympathetic to Landon Donovan. He seems like a good dude and generally is totally pushing, you know, everything in the right direction as far as his sport goes, but it's just weird that he's like getting all self-righteous about this and telling Carlos Bocanegra how he should feel while he's like being paid by Wells Fargo to endorse Mexico. It's like if you're like a paid endorser and then like attacking someone else for their sincerity and saying that they should feel a certain way because of like their heritage, it's really weird. But Nick, let's like separate that out and just what is your feeling on whether Americans should root for Mexico, irrespective of whether Landon Donovan tells us to or not?
Well, as VP of Consumer Outreach for Wells Fargo, I also support Landon Donovan in this. No, I think it's very college football, isn't it? You know, if a LSU fan will support an SEC team in a bowl game, it kind of makes their conference appear stronger or makes their own victory seem better. So I have no problem with someone's American supporting Mexico. I personally am rooting for them in this tournament because I think they're fun to watch. And if the United States aren't in it, what's the harm in that? I'm also not
the harm is emboldening them, strengthening them for our future CONCACAF clashes. Stefan, I thought the part about fans throwing urine was kind of like a cheap shot, but just because Even if that is true, which I'm not sure that it is true.
It is true. It happened at least in the 90s.
Didn't Lady Donovan aughts. Pee in the center of the Azteca? Is that a big scandal?
Too. Yeah, that was a scandal too.
No, the pee goes
It wasn't
both
like
ways.
In the center of the field like a Terrell Owens thing. It was
Terrell Owens didn't pee. Somewhere. He just stood there.
I know. It's but the parallel.
Anyway, it's not fair to count fans' behavior against the Mexican national team. It's like back to LSU again. It's not like I maybe should, but it's like LSU has like a ton of like horrible fans who say and do horrible things, but like I don't necessarily count that in my calculus about whether I'm going to root for the team or not.
I think I was probably most cringy about Donovan bringing in the current political relations between the United States and Mexico into this rivalry. That just makes me a little uncomfortable. I mean, But why?
Like that seems relevant.
You think that seems relevant? I mean, it's still like if I can isolate just the pure soccer rivalry, particularly over the last 20 years, I can't find reason to root for Mexico. I like watching them play, and I think they played a great game against Germany. And in some ways, there's some Schadenfreude in watching Germany fail. And there's a little part of me that says, yeah, that was kind of cool that Mexico did well. Yeah, let them get out of the group and lose in the round of 16 again. That would be okay with me.
All right.
I like how Donovan's extended kind of righteous response to Carlos Bocanegra was just the text or the tweet, really, question mark. It was – he uncorked a lot just based on the responding to really.
That set the man off. All right. Messi missed a penalty. Ronaldo scored 3 goals. I'm sure we'll get to them on future episodes of this podcast. But we'll leave that as a homework assignment for the listeners. Compare Lionel Messi to Cristiano Ronaldo, because that's not at all a hacky thing to do. But Nick, the new thing in this tournament, the thing that's already affected the outcome of multiple games is VAR, video assistant review, which is the instant replay system in soccer. You've assessed it. You've written about it. How do you feel like the rollout has gone so far?
So far, so good. The only problem is I don't know whether they call it VAR or VAR. But I guess that's a matter that we can kind of pick apart as the tournament goes on. But for a system that has had, you know, not much, there's not much experience with it. It's very new. It has effectively gotten every single call it's been involved in correct. Sure, there have been times where the referees have ignored VAR or the VAR ref has not exactly chimed in to alert the referee of a foul or indiscretion, but all the actual reviews have been called correctly, which is an amazing kind of early achievement for it. I'm sure it's going to mess up, you know, in a very spectacular way some point in the tournament, but so far so good.
France and Australia was an example where France won 2-1 with they were awarded a penalty by VAR that was the decisive goal in the game, Stefan.
My favorite part of VAR is when the referee makes the little TV symbol with his fingers. I think that's a great skill for the referee to have. A little miming nice there.
Yeah, if like a big gust, he pretended a big gust of wind came and he was kind of fighting against that, or he was pulling himself back onto the pitch with an imaginary rope. Maybe
yes.
He can add that.
I mean, I think it also opens the door in future tournaments for referees being trained to make all calls in sort of mime. Like reenacting what the call is for offside or for a foul, red card.
Very avant-garde, very Parisian.
Yes, it would be. As for VAR itself, I'm not a huge fan. I find that part of the game should be, you know, particularly when we're talking about it reminds me of the sort of when a guy slides into second base and his foot comes a micrometer off of the base and we call that now. When there is a tiny touch in the box that is a discretionary observable offense, I find it hard to be sympathetic to the missed call. I think that there should be some room for referee error in split second actions. And look, soccer is hard. There's only one ref on the field making calls from a greater distance than in other sports very often. The sideline refs are way far away, and it's difficult for them to adjudicate even the stuff that they're able to adjudicate. I don't have a problem with VAR for ball over the goal line, even for offside, which is, you know, again, a really hard, but usually non-contact. But for the contact fouls, I find it like it does slow the game down and it does take some emotional impact out of the run of play.
Yeah, I agree. I think it seems like the system should stop, but the system never stops. There's always replay creep. It should stop with ball over the goal line, offside, and I guess maybe out of bounds, although out of bounds isn't like a huge deal in soccer. But the judgment calls, the subjective calls, I think the only other alternative here, given that we live in an age when apparently this needs to exist in every sport, is to put more referees on the field, which to me seems like it would be better.
That's a terrible idea.
Well,
you have referees arguing with each other, getting in the way. They already get in the way enough as it is.
Just the balls, they would be peppered with balls everywhere.
Exactly.
Well, here's the problem. The reason that this exists now, I think, and the reason that people feel like there's a need to review these like calls to see if, you know, players are like simulating or whether they really got hit, is that there's an enormous incentive in soccer, just because goals are so valuable, to, you know, play up contact or pretend contact exists when it doesn't exist at all. And the fact that there's only referee creates conditions where that's extremely likely to succeed. And so soccer has basically done this to itself. And the only way to fix it, as I said, I think, is to add more referees. Because if you don't have a replay system and you have a sport where individual goals are so valuable and you only have one referee, like what's the this is what's going
to
happen.
The other way would be to penalize simulation more aggressively than referees currently do.
Like after the game is over?
But I believe they can do that with video assist if they go back and see that it was a dive.
Video assist just fixes everything in Nick's world.
I love it. I think if any sport can, you know, stand to have a few breaks here and there for a video review, it's soccer, because it's so free flowing and it kind of the drama builds.
It's so free flowing. Why don't we just stop it for a while?
Why don't we make it less free flowing?
The thing that's good about it.
It's the only reason I'm watching the World Cup from here on out. It's VAR. I have a VAR jersey on. I got my little VAR pennant and scarf.
Well, we also just haven't quite figured out, I think, as fans, like maybe people who are like way more up to date and into soccer than I am, maybe know, like, but as I'm watching the game now, I don't understand, like, can you stop the game for this? How long are they going to stop the game? Is this a thing where they're going to whistle it in from the sideline and they'll just tell the ref in the earpiece? Or is the ref going to actually have to, like, go off the field? I still haven't, like, quite figured it out. So you're always just kind of like, does this really count? Are we going to stop now? It's just kind of confusing at this stage.
And there's no hood on the field for the referees to look under. So it's very confusing for American fans.
I like it. As I wrote, it looks like a kind of a airport ticketing kiosk, so I can relate to it. It feels like going to O'Hare and checking in. But I think after a single stoppage of play, if VAR is not consulted, then it's over and you can't go back. Okay. So there's no 15 minutes later, they can't do a VAR.
Let's end this with a quick thoughts on Fox Sports. Nick, how do you think they're doing so far?
I think they've benefited from low expectations. It's not great. It's not terrible. You can't exactly tell that most of the crews aren't in Russia live commentating. However, the ones who are there, you don't really get any benefit from them being in the stadium. There's no real up-close insight. Tony Viola is not wowing me with his knowledge and his keen eye yet. But other than that, it's better than it should be, but not as good as it could be.
So it's better than nothing, is what you're saying.
The games are on TV.
The games are on television. You can watch them, and there are people speaking English with American accents.
I wake up and soccer is on my television. I'm not going to complain.
I think Tony Meola is awful. His insights are pretty unimpressive, and his voice is just incredibly.
Former
American goalkeeper who tried out for the New York Jets, and his voice is really monotonous and bland. And that is not a good quality to have. I think John Strong and Stuart Holden, who I think are the A-team, are the better of all of them. I don't know. Are John and Stuart, are they in
I think
they
they're
LA?
The A-team.
They're in Russia. They're in Russia.
Allie Wagner, first woman to call a men's World Cup game in the U.S.
She's been good.
Her
and Derek
fine.
Ray,
yep.
yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And this is all, of course, because the U.S. part of this is because the U.S. didn't qualify. Fox decided to hold back sending a larger contingent of announcers to Russia because they wouldn't need.
So this is all Bruce Arena's fault, too.
This is also all Bruce Arena's fault. Yes.
I don't think it's that bad. I think it's hard to evaluate because there's an opportunity cost here. Like, you don't know. It's just hard as you're watching a game to, like, know how much better it could be if there were better production values, if they were at the stadium and not in a studio. You disagree?
And I don't even think that's necessarily the issue. I think that the studio crew has been pretty lame in Russia with Lawless and three others rotating. I found ESPN's coverage to be a lot better in previous World Cups, and I think NBC's coverage week to week with the Premiership and other games has been far superior.
Yeah, we're really spoiled because ESPN's in Brazil, their coverage was just fantastic. And as you said, NBC's ongoing Premier League coverage is great. So as soccer fans in America, we're just simply spoiled. And maybe we deserve a kind of clunker of a Fox World Cup here and there.
All right. Nick Green, get back to your TV. Sweden beat South Korea while we were recording. 1-0.
Go VAR. All right. VAR did it.
That was another. It was a VAR action there.
Oh, yeah.
Nick Green writes about VAR and other World Cup things for Slate. Thanks, Nick.
Thank you.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Before we get to chatting about golfers who whine about how golf is too hard, I wanted to let you know that in our bonus segment for Slate Plus members, Nick Green will be back to talk about rumors that Kawhi Leonard wants to leave San Antonio for the Lakers and whether a LeBron-Kawhi super team in L.A. would be fun and good for America. If you want to hear that conversation, you should join Slate Plus. It's just $35 for the first year. You can sign up at slate.com/hangupplus. Joining us for our next segment is Slate's golf correspondent, Jim Newell, who was watching golf this weekend when he was allegedly at a wedding. What is
that's
that about?
False. What's
that's
that about, Jim? That's false. More lies from Josh.
On Sunday at Shinnecock Hills, which Jim was watching when he probably should have been at a brunch of some kind.
Maybe. That is maybe.
Brooks Koepka won his second straight U.S. Open, shooting a final round 68 to finish the tournament at 1 over par, one shot ahead of England's Tommy Fleetwood. Let's listen to a snippet of Koepka's post-tournament press conference.
It's incredible. I looked at all these names a million times, it felt like, last year, just looking at everybody. And, you know, to have my name on there twice is pretty incredible. And to go back to back is even more extraordinary.
Man, is that guy boring. I mean,
you
might have thought,
wrong, though. It is indeed extraordinary and super cool.
You might have thought that I put that clip in just for the news value. But the reason that I put the clip in is because, A, I wanted to say you got to come harder than that two-time U.S. Open champion Brooks Koepka. But it also leads into my question about Brooks Koepka, Jim, which is, as a general sports fan who follows golf around the majors and also just enjoys watching a little Tiger Woods now and again, I want to be well-informed about the game. But do I really need to now, like, know stuff about Brooks Koepka? I do not want to know about Brooks Koepka. He seems boring. Is he going to be like such a great, amazing stalwart of the game that I'll be forced to now learn facts about Brooks Koepka?
Well, I mean, you sort of hit it there when, I mean, you said he's boring. You don't actually have to learn a whole lot about him because there isn't that much about him.
I now know everything.
I think you know everything. Yeah. Well, did you watch any of it last year? If you watched any of the U.S. Open last year, you've watched.
I think I was out of town or something.
Well, then
I think I was at a wedding.
You know, because this is only his third PGA Tour win, but two of them have been U.S. Opens, which is pretty incredible. I'm surprised that he hasn't won more regular tour events.
Well, if you knew a little bit more about him, Jim, you'd know that he's had a wrist injury.
Well, no, at the beginning he had 4 months off at the beginning of this year, but he's been on tour. So he actually took an interesting path to the PGA Tour. He played in Europe for a while and got his PGA Tour card that way.
Brooks is American.
Yes, he's American. He went to Florida State.
So he backdoored his way into getting a PGA Tour card.
Yeah, and there are like a few who have done that. There's another good young player who's doing that right now.
Is that considered cheating? On par with like putting a moving ball?
I don't think it's quite that level of cheating. Putting a moving ball.
Where would you rather play? Like have a play in a tournament in Berlin or in like Chattanooga?
Yeah.
Good move.
Chattanooga has really
fast. You have to apologize to Chattanooga.
Chattanooga has really fast municipal internet. So I think maybe Chattanooga is an up and comer. but back to Brooks, like the most interesting thing that I've read about him in the last couple of days was that he's like a dude who played a lot of sports growing up. He, the ESPN piece that I read, his swing coach, Claude Harmon III, apparently all swing coaches are in the Harmon family.
Harmons have been swing coaches for a million years, yeah.
He says Brooks has never been a golf nerd. He's just this like jock. And I was wondering how you felt about that, Jim, as a nerd,
yeah.
As a golf nerd.
A golf nerd specifically, yeah.
Yeah. Does it feel like Brooks Koepka and his like muscle bound like pals like Dustin Johnson?
Good looking
are they taking,
let's cut to the chase here.
Are they taking the game away from the like more nerdy dweeby types? Is this bad for Jim Newell?
Your Tommy Fleetwood, for instance.
I think it's bad for me because it really hampers my ability to get on the PGA Tour eventually if actual good athletes, you know, are playing. But I think that was a long shot anyway. But you see that, I mean, there have been, you know, in the last 10 years, a lot of big, strong players who could do a lot of different sports. Like Gary Woodland is a tour player. He played college basketball. But I mean, it's still
even Jason Day, strapping dude.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you can have a lot of guys who can just hit it 350, but I mean, you still have to have a lot of touch to get around. And I mean, that's where a lot of them can't put it all together. And it looks like Brooks, has the whole thing put together right now. But there are definitely better athletes coming
But isn't
in.
This is the Tiger influence, right? Like it's okay to go to the gym and it's okay to be buff and it's okay to be strong.
Yeah, I think you're drawing better athletes into it because it's not, you know, quite as lame a sport as it was for its first 400 years.
And the parallel is like, you know, baseball in the 90s that people realized not only could you lift weights and still not have your swing be hampered.
Wait, what are you suggesting about Brooks Koepka, Stefan?
No, I didn't mean to go there. But there was a, you know, there was a trend of, you know, in baseball it was believed that you shouldn't lift weights because it'll restrict your swing and it'll restrict your arm motion. And in golf, I think it was a similar thought.
And you actually,
Tiger has disproved that.
Well, you actually hear that a lot still from old timers. I mean, by old timers, I mean people who played in the 80s and 90s, that these guys who are trying to get really jacked are just ruining their swing because they don't have as much flexibility with it. But
that's exactly what they said in baseball.
Yeah.
I mean, didn't Tiger kind of disprove that toward the, you know, the end of his major runs when he was buff? I mean, he obviously wasn't huge at the beginning.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there were some people who said that Tiger was putting, I think where Tiger was a little different, that he was putting so much time in the room that he was maybe hurting his body a little bit.
Without all that Navy SEAL shit. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
We've gone way too long talking about Brooks Koepka.
Wait, his girlfriend starred in Attack of the 50-Foot Cheerleader.
All right.
She's going to be in Sharknado 5. Which is due out in August.
One of the top five Sharknados. Let's talk about the players whining about how Shinnecock Hills was too hard. You love when that happens, Stefan.
I love it when this happens. Oh, this is my favorite thing in sports. And it might have been too hard. So let's look at it first rationally, Jim. Those pin placements on Saturday were unfair on two holes from what I read and what players were saying.
In my opinion, on four holes, but yes.
Four holes, two holes, four holes, whatever. We can quibble, Jim. We'll do that off mic. So meaning they were too close to the edge of the green.
You affirm what Stefan said. You don't say four, you say two. There was two holes.
Too close to the edge of the green and too close to a slope or basically on a slope, right? And then they didn't water the greens and the sun came out and they got really, really fast and it was impossible to keep the ball on the green. But that's kind of cool, right? I mean, it's fun to see great athletes being presented with conditions. It's not every sport where you can vary the conditions to make the challenge more difficult.
Right. I mean, I loved it. I love the suffering. I love the carnage. I was fine with the unfair pin location, you know, quote unquote unfair pin locations. I guess what was annoying to me a little bit was that the golf course on Saturday played completely different between Saturday morning and Saturday afternoon. So if it's going to be, you know, completely unfair, that's fine with me. I just wish it was consistent throughout that all the day. Because
what do you do? Play in a dome? I mean, the
no, I mean, there's like, not much you can do. It. I mean, I think
you can water the greens, right?
Yeah, or you just move the pin like, you know, a yard closer to the middle, so that if the wind kicks up and you're downwind and it's hot and baked out, that you, you know, can actually hold the green a little bit.
Is that okay to do? I mean, in the rules, can you shift the pin placements during the round?
No.
Right.
No.
So that's what
I mean,
implying.
It's just something
so
that they,
like at
no,
one
no,
o'clock,
it's something that they need to figure out ahead of the day, because it's something where, I mean, they were pushing it so much to the edge that, you know, the wind picks up 5 or 10 miles more than they were predicting. Then you have a few holes that, you know, you can't actually hold the green on them. So, I mean, I thought it was just a little silly that, like, on Saturday, Finau and Berger, who, you know, shot really good rounds, but they shot them in the morning round, you know, they were able to get from 45th place to first place because they were playing completely different course from the guys in the afternoon. So I'm a little bit relieved that one of the guys who was playing in the afternoon, who was in good position on Saturday to begin with, Brooks Koepka, actually ended up winning.
This happens in the British Open all the time, right, where the wind will just
kick life. This isn't the first time it's ever happened.
Sure. And it happens in downhill skiing. I mean, this is a thing that happens when you play sports outdoors in which the conditions are
like the USGA now. They were saying, this is an outdoor game, okay?
Well, all right, let's evaluate.
You sound like the man.
That's who I aspire to be. Let's kind of categorize or taxonomize the different kinds of whining and which are our favorite. There's Ian Poulter. Thanks, guys. Did Bozo set the course up, or are the USGA going to accept responsibility or just say, if we had a mulligan, I would have liked about 6 mulligans today, but they're not allowed at this level, quote, apparently. My favorite thing about that is that it just like doesn't make any sense syntactically.
Apparently, as I just looked in the rules books and found out.
Rafa Cabrera Bello said it was not a fair test of golf. Greens were unplayable with unnecessary pin positions. USGA found a way to make us look like fools on the course.
No.
A pity they managed to destroy a beautiful golf course. That was like a kind of consistent thread where everyone was like, it's a shame what they've done to Shinnecock. Beautiful, beautiful Shinnecock.
I know. They burned it to the ground, Shinnecock. And then, they just put some water on it that night, and it was fine. It played really well yesterday. So, yeah, they just don't.
Dude shot a 63 yesterday.
It's like the one tournament a year, or, you know, sometimes the British Open can actually be worse. But it's the one time a year where they look like fools and they can't handle it. I don't know. They're very pampered athletes. So,
Stefan, you wanted to talk about Tommy Fleetwood, who shot 63 on Sunday, had an 8-foot putt for 62 that would have gotten him to one over, which is where Brooks Koepka ended. Guy has long hair.
He didn't used to have long hair, so I'm interested in the transition of Tommy Fleetwood. He's gone total rocker. I think Steve Buscemi would play him in the Tommy Fleetwood story.
Yeah, I've only known him with long hair.
I saw a picture of him earlier from 5 or 6 years ago.
Oh, okay.
Very clean cut, it looked like to me, unless I was looking at an imposter.
Well, now he has a distinct look, which, you know, is good. So not everyone's just a Brooks kept a machine
right, he doesn't,
out there,
and he's not like a stud, Tommy. He's a little guy. He's a thin dude.
Yeah.
He's a reedy Brit.
He's a reedy Brit. He's got 4 wins on the European Tour. I don't know if I'd ever heard of him before. He finished 4th in the US Open though, right? Previously.
Yeah, he was 4th last year.
Yeah. His other wins have been in Abu Dhabi, France, and Scotland. And he also won the Kazakhstan Open in 2011.
Yeah, that's a biggie. 5th major.
Good for that guy. Well, it's the second tournament in a row where the dude who made the big charge on Sunday doesn't end up winning, which is sad.
That's like, another one of my favorite golf things is when the dude makes the big charge and his name is up there and the cameras keep trying to find him to see what he's doing while everyone else is
trying not
to blow it.
Well, Patrick Reed, we should also briefly talk about. He made a big charge in the beginning there too. And I think everyone who was watching the U.S. Open on television was rooting for him to start hitting it in the rough, and he did. So I think everyone willed him into losing.
Congratulations, fans. All right, let's get to Phil Mickelson on Saturday during that round that was so unfair that was designed by Bozo. He was 10 over par, and on the 13th hole, was that one of the ones that was unfair?
Yes.
The 13th? He hit a putt, it went past the hole, and wait, we've got a clip of this. Let's listen.
This for bogey a moment ago at 13.
Well, his speed has been terrible. Whoa.
Whoa.
Wow.
That's stunning.
I love that you have no idea what's going on just listening to the clip, but they seem really appalled.
Joe Buck does play-by-play, right?
He does. So what happened was he putted the ball past the hole, and then he hit it again back towards the
while the ball was still moving. He ran after it.
Putt-putt style?
Yeah. Yeah, like a four-year-old playing putt-putt.
He claimed afterwards that he did this intentionally, that he it was like a strategic maneuver, and that he was going to take the two-shot penalty because if he had actually had to play the ball when it stopped, he would have shot a higher score. He's very, very smart guy, this Phil Mickelson.
Yeah.
What do you think of what he said and what the reaction was?
What he said was, I think, a little bogus. It made it sound like he was, you know, thinking completely rationally when he did it, and it was just, oh, I want to do this little experiment, you know. I think he was probably very mad, and that was probably a bigger part of it. I do believe that he's thought about doing this before, but, the math didn't really add up to me that he was somehow going to, you know, he could save stroke somehow this way, because it was, you know, two-stroke penalty, and then when he whacked it back towards the hole, that was another shot, and they took two more putts. So I think he was just a little more head up than he let on to.
Yeah, it was weird because, like, everybody else was, like, really willing to talk about how they were so mad.
Yeah.
And then Phil, who was clearly the maddest of anyone, was like, no, I wasn't that mad. It was fine.
Yeah, but that was like 2 hours later when he had a chance to go into the cabin or whatever they call it.
I think he assembled his team, his crisis
team together and figured out what he should say to the Fox cameras when he emerged from the clubhouse. I think Phil is full of shit, and I think that, hot take, he should have been disqualified. I mean, look at the rules. I read the rules. I read all the stories about this. The rule isn't intended to help a golfer mitigate a bad shot. That's not the point of this rule, the two-stroke penalty for hitting a moving ball. It is intended to punish a player who hits a ball unthinkingly or in anger, who hits a ball not in the spirit of the game, right? And the spirit of the game is like rule one, literally, in the golf rule book. Phil was exploiting the letter of the rule. Phil was exploiting the letter of the rule to gain a possible advantage to compensate for a shitty shot.
Yeah, I mean, we both enjoyed that, like, Fox just brought on some, like, random British guy on Sunday morning to say, I think he's a chump. I think he made a complete mistake. In Britain, we would call him an ass, a silly ass.
And then I
love how you just, like, bring out a British guy to say that in Britain we would call it an ass. That's good television production.
We don't have that word in America, no. So it was nice for him to tell us.
Sorry, I pronounced it wrong. We call him an ass.
A silly ass.
But this was an example of on Twitter or elsewhere on the internet, you can basically find every iteration of every opinion. And there are certainly enough people out there saying Phil was horrible and had disgraced the game that, like, the backlash could then come in where people were like, oh, like, people are taking this way too seriously. All of you, like, golf people with your rules of the game. If you wanted to be, like, outraged about Phil or outraged about the outrage about Phil, there was certainly more than enough fodder there for your pleasure this weekend.
Yeah, I think that one thing that was annoying about it, and I think this is something that annoyed the other players too, was that Phil finds a way to do sort of goofy things that draw all the attention to him and then sort of distracts from the rest of the tournament. And especially, you know,
people should have been focusing on how horrible the course was.
Exactly. Well, people should have been focused on the leaders. But, Fox, which I think does generally a pretty good job. I mean, it was just, I would say the majority of time was spent talking about Phil and, like, Curtis Strange chasing Phil around.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think a lot of people just, you know, Phil finds a way to bring all the attention to him, which rubs some people the wrong way.
When Tiger's not around for the weekend, you got to fill the airtime with something rather than just showing golf. Yeah. There you go. Jim Newell watches golf on the weekends. He also works for Slate. He writes about Congress and sometimes golf.
Yeah.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now. getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Sure, the World Cup is the most entertaining sports spectacle on the planet, but as we enjoy the goals and the thunderclaps, we should also think about the venality that underlines the entire proposition. That is the subject of a new book, Red Card: How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal, which the New York Times calls an engrossing and jaw-dropping tale of international intrigue. It's written by Ken Bensinger. He is an investigative reporter for BuzzFeed and a former Fresh from College colleague of mine at the Wall Street Journal, where in 1998, he profiled Boomer Esiason's 7-bedroom, 6.5-bath for sale suburban Cincinnati home. Ken, congratulations on the book.
Thanks for having me, Steph. I cannot believe you found that Boomer Esiason article. Wow.
Well, why are you not congratulating Boomer Esiason on his big house?
We don't know that it's sold.
There was so much. There was such a fun article to write. Among the highlights were the fact that he had trouble selling a house with a sports court that was painted with a Jets logo. No one wanted that. He also called me up and tried to strong-arm me by impressing me that Boomer Esiason was calling me directly and wanted me to know that I needed to write a positive article about his house.
Well, it was either that article, Ken, or Toys for Real Men, Weekend Woodworkers Turned to High-End Power Tools. I had trouble deciding.
Let's get to the book, Stefan.
Let's get to the book. Ken, the book is a narrative about the meticulous case that was built by U.S. tax agents and prosecutors that resulted in guilty pleas or convictions of more than a dozen international soccer executives from the Western Hemisphere. Of course, corruption in soccer goes back decades to the 1970s, but I want to start with the bidding for the current World Cup in Russia that we are watching now. How does that connect to the U.S. case?
It apparently connects to everything. The history is that in 2010, there was a vote to determine where this current World Cup would be held, and there was six different countries competing for it. Two of the bids were combined bids, Spain and Portugal. Belgium and Netherlands were competing against England and Mother Russia. And England was, by everyone's account, the clear favorite to win it. But it turns out Russia had other ideas in mind. And it developed that Russia was going to do anything it could to win the bid, which they ultimately did. And England, which was spending quite a bit of money to win the bid and was putting forward their what they called their three lions, Prince William, David Cameron, and David Beckham, to promote their bid, hired a bunch of intelligence types to look into the other competing bids. And one of the people they hired was a man who was not famous at the time, who has become quite famous now, by the name of Christopher Steele. And this was among Christopher Steele's first ever commissions as a independent non-spy in the world of private corporate intelligence. And he starts digging around in this and starts discovering that Russia seems to be doing a number of underhanded things to get the bid, such as giving FIFA voters paintings potentially looted from the Hermitage, making secret gas deals with Qatar, and involving Roman Abramovich, who's the owner of Chelsea and a close bosom buddy of Vladimir Putin's, to go out there and do the dirty work.
So we all know about Sepp Blatter. You got started writing about this stuff, writing about the kind of amazingly corrupt and rich character of Chuck Blazer, the American soccer official. Just tell folks who aren't familiar with Chuck Blazer, just give a little bit of a sketch of this dude.
If you can sort of imagine the father on the side of your AYSO game who says things like, if I ran soccer, here's the rules I would put into the game. That's Chuck Blazer gone good. He was the father on the side of youth soccer games in the 1970s in Westchester County who claimed he would someday take over soccer, and he did. He eventually became one of the 24 most powerful people in all of soccer, a member of the FIFA Executive Committee, the number two in the CONCACAF, which, as you all know, is the beautifully named regional confederation overseeing North Central America and Caribbean soccer, and just generally an incredibly powerful soccer voice, a guy who probably had a big role in creation of the women's U.S. national team and the Women's World Cup, and also getting Major League Soccer its first TV contract. So that's one side of him. The other side is that he was skimming money from the sport constantly, taking commissions on everything he did, pocketing it, taking bribes, and generally enriching himself while putting every single expense in his life on soccer's credit card. All this was being done while he refused to pay taxes. So he didn't file income tax for decades. And in the end, that became a critical lever for the IRS to hook him and make him a cooperator in the investigation.
And that's one of the interesting things in this story, right? This starts as basically a tax case, or at least it's the cudgel that the IRS can use to get Blazer to flip. And when they do, and Blazer turns out, I mean, you didn't mention the fact that he's also this 400-pound guy riding around on a motorized scooter because his health is so impaired, and he's got this giant gray beard and this bizarro website where he would post photos of himself with dignitaries and celebrities from around the world. But they get Blazer to flip, and Blazer turns out to be one of the great cooperating witnesses of all time.
He's in the Cooperating Witness Hall of Fame. First ballot.
He's a first ballot candidate for sure. I mean, he basically reveals what he has been doing for 20 plus years, which begins with this crazy contract that he wrote for himself in CONCACAF that gave him the rights to 10% of like everything. Revenue from television contracts, marketing deals, you name it, tickets, food, whatever, that nobody knew about. And what strikes me, Ken, is just how unsophisticated and how just rotten to the core soccer organizations have been. And yeah, CONCACAF is this small region within this global entity. But by the same token, it's throwing off hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue through big tournaments and other events.
Yeah, that's right. And I think one of Chuck Blazer's geniuses, and you're right, he was rather colorful. Anyone who takes a moment to Google him will discover his affection for Halloween costumes, including pirates with real parrots on his shoulder and Star Wars characters and the like. And it's quite entertaining. But he had a real gift for understanding marketing and seeing opportunity. And he saw that even though the revenue of this thing was nothing when he took over, it could be huge. And he wrote himself this secret contract and had a huge incentive thus to grow the sport. And he did. His defenders will sometimes even say, well, yeah, it's true. He stole a lot of money, but, you know, the sport's a lot bigger because of him. It's sort of that's the kind of justification you hear. But it's, you know, it's also a testament to sort of how the impunity you see in soccer, we've seen in soccer, because the truth is, as I mentioned earlier, if it started as a Russia investigation, well, turns out Russians cover their tracks pretty well. And I think the prosecutors in this case discovered quickly that it was hard to make a case against the Russians.
Yeah, covered their tracks by like destroying the computers and the servers that,
right.
All of the bid materials were on, right?
That's right. They leave no paper trail. But all the soccer officials believe that they are above all oversight. And so they didn't even bother really being careful at some point. And it was exceedingly easy. I mean, they were sending wire transfers through the U.S. So that's how the case gets made, right? That's what Blazer explains to them, how the bribes work. And then it's relatively easy once they understand the concept to just find wire transfer after wire transfer going through American banks, something that I think a Russian spy would never do, or a Russian Kremlin operative. And so suddenly all of the Americas just collapses because they've all been bribing each other like crazy. And all it took was a Blazer to explain how it worked and one or two other cooperators. And it was off to the jury box.
As just a feat of reporting, this is incredible. And I'm just wondering, journalistically, was the challenge here getting people to talk to you, or was it that you just had so much information? There are obviously like a huge number of ways into this story, different agencies that were investigating, like people in different, like basically every country in the entire world could be a source here just because of all the, you know, FIFA member organizations. So I'm just wondering, like, as a reporter, was it more challenging to get information or to sift all the ample information that was out there?
It's hard to pick because they're both true, right? It was very difficult to get all the information I wanted, but at the same time, by the time I was ready to write, it was a massive plethora, plethora of information to work with. So the testament to that is that my first draft was about twice as long as the book ended up being, and great, huge sections of soccer history had to go by the wayside. But if you ever privately over a malted beverage of your choice would like to talk about the 1994 World Cup and the intrigue involving that, or even better, how the U.S. bid for and lost the 1986 World Cup, we can talk about that at length.
Who was your favorite on the record source or just kind of character who, if you read the book, you might not get a sense that like so much of the material that you got was from this individual?
Well, my favorite on the record source was definitely Sepp Blatter. One of my two interviews with him, I think, is illustrative of the problems. I went to Zurich in February 2016 to watch the election of a new president. And Blatter at that point had resigned and then been banned from FIFA. His initial ban for ethics violations had been 8 years. He was reduced to 6 years. This was a man who was now disgraced. I was in Zurich to see this election of his successor, and FIFA did not like the fact that I was going to write a book. They were unhappy with it. They were not being helpful. In fact, they were really getting in my way, and they refused to accredit me for the election. There was 900 accredited journalists at this. I mean, anyone with a pulse was getting into this. It was in a giant hockey arena where anyone could fit in. They refused to give it to me, and I was despondent because I'd had months of people refusing to talk to me. And then my phone rang, and it was Sepp Blatter. And he said, why don't you come over to my house and we'll watch the vote on my iPad together. I took a taxi over there, and it turns out to be this immaculately, incredibly Swiss house, which if you know any Swiss people or their aesthetic is this, they have this talent for making emptiness and sort of lack of material objects look incredibly rich and expensive and gaudy somehow. I don't know how they do it. And his house was like that. The void impressed you with its value. And we sat there, and the only decoration in his house was a picture of the previous Pope and him together, and all these FIFA coasters everywhere that you had to put all your drinks and everything on.
Was this a good use of American government prosecutorial resources to try to take down this international sporting organization?
I mean, I think, you know, if you measure it just in resources, I think it probably paid for itself, right? I mean, the amount of money that the government has already recovered and plans to continue to recover is pretty large. I think it's somewhere around $500 million at this point. So I think that it's probably covered itself. Although I guess there's going to be a fund for victims to claim some of that money. So FIFA has already claimed itself as a victim in one of the incredible legal pieces of acrobatics in history.
Can I be a victim? Because I watched some World Cup games that were disappointing.
I mean, I would say that actually you, according to the definition of the government, you are a victim. If you've watched any soccer, you're a stakeholder. But I think, you know, they sort of envisioned the victims of all this were sort of the little crying child in a developing country who doesn't have proper shoes to put on his feet to play the game. That's the way they envisioned it. But I think, you know, Americans who are angry the USMNT didn't make the World Cup should also perhaps receive victim status.
The problem with that and FIFA's theory that those are, or that the U.S. government's belief that these are the true victims is that FIFA and all of these local confederations, all these local soccer officials like Jack Warner, particularly in CONCACAF, who ran CONCACAF with Chuck Blazer as his own personal piggy bank, these guys were skimming that money. That's the money that they were already taking away. So the irony of like giving that back to FIFA to redistribute to these confederations who are probably still behaving in all sorts of illegal ways is pretty naive.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is the problem, right? So there's something that people kept telling me about law enforcement people about how when you deal with what they consider to be criminal organizations, which is what they ultimately decided FIFA and all its dependent organizations were just a giant mafia organization, is that when you cut off the head, another head comes up and takes over its place.
And that's the legacy of FIFA. I mean, it's, you get one corrupt person and then the next guy is like, hold my frappe while I take more money.
That's right. I mean, look at Infantino, the new president, right? He says, I'm going to clean things up, but his campaign promises are exactly like Sepp Blatter's, except larger, right? Instead of $1 million, I'll give you $5 million. And, you know, instead of a 32-team World Cup, I'll give you a 48-team World Cup. Well, all that is just, I'll generate more money and I'll spread that out more as patronage, and everyone will be happy because you'll just be taking baths and more money, and you'll just, and there'll be no complaints. And, you know, I think the vote for the 2026 World Cup, the united bid of Canada, Mexico, and the U.S. versus Morocco, the fact the U.S. wins, the united bid wins, is probably a good thing in the sense that Morocco was perhaps ill-prepared to do it. But it's also an indication that ultimately, despite the rancor of so many voters who are angry at the U.S. for its investigation and so many countries who don't like the Trump administration, is an indication that what they really like is the green stuff. And they know that a united World Cup is going to bring way more money into their pockets.
Ken, one last question, and that is, like, through all of this, through this investigation that was conducted by U.S. authorities that ensnared one of the top American soccer officials of all time, it kind of beggars belief that no one was able to stop it in the United States, that American soccer executives didn't know about these shady marketing deals and the kind of bribery and other illicit behavior that was going on in its own confederation, that it didn't raise eyebrows. Why should we believe that the United States wasn't more aware of what was going on and was just playing along, because that's the belief of how you have to deal with these, with people in FIFA?
I think the pattern we see with soccer is that there's a lot of people who love to be along for the ride, whether they want the money or they want the glory or they want the power. There's a lot of people who are willing to put aside what might be ethical issues because it benefits them personally. And so you have sort of, you know, a community of people who take bribes, and then you have a community of people who just don't want to look at it. They want to turn a blind eye. Sunil Gulati is someone who I think
president of the U.S. Soccer Federation.
That's right. And a very close friend of Chuck Blazer's. This is a guy who came up in youth soccer just a couple years behind Blazer, knew him, was protected by him, also was under the wing of a lot of the other people who built sort of contemporary American soccer. And largely because of Blazer's help, ends up getting these increasingly prominent positions in the sport, culminating in the CONCACAF Executive Committee, and then the U.S. Soccer Presidency, and then ultimately the FIFA Executive Committee, which is now the FIFA Executive Council. So he becomes incredibly powerful in the sport. But the whole time a big chunk of the time, he's getting free office space from Blazer inside CONCACAF's Trump Tower offices. He's sitting on these different committees thanks to Blazer and other people's help. And he's allegedly in a position where he has a fiduciary responsibility to look at the books. And when CONCACAF, the scandal of all their incredible financial abuses, comes out, reporters asked Sunil, you know, what's going on? Weren't you supposed to look at these books? This is a guy, by the way, who teaches economics at Columbia University, a highly educated son of a mathematician. And they ask him, well, aren't you responsible for looking at these books? And he says, well, they were audited, so I just trusted they were okay. I don't think that would fly in the corporate sector. That wouldn't cut it. But somehow no one noticed when he said, well, they're audited, so I thought they were okay. No one ever looked at Blazer's contract, and that includes Gulati. And so one of the impressions is that the people who are along for the ride didn't want to know. They just wanted to continue to enjoy the positions they had.
Ken Bensinger is the author of Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. Ken, thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me, gentlemen.
Can you set the stage a little bit so people understand what happened?
In 1969, 14 black student-athletes were kicked off their university's American football team for planning a show of support against racism.
We were really protesting our treatment on the field.
Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service tells their story.
We became brothers that day when he did that to us.
We made a change.
Fighting for what we deserve.
Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
And now it is time for After Balls. And I think we should name our After Ball after something, related to the sportocratic conversation that we just had, Josh.
Let's do it.
I read Ken Bensinger's book because I'm that kind of a host. I read the books. There was a little passage in there where one of the IRS guys wanted to name the FIFA investigation, because you got to give an investigation a name, right?
Of course.
He wanted to call...
That's like most of the fun of being
a prosecutor,
fed.
Being a Fed, of working on a case for like 6 years.
Yeah.
He wanted to call it Operation Own Goal.
I think Jean-Claude Van Damme was in that one.
That would be a good name for the movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Better than United Passions.
And so what happened after Operation Own Goal was floated as an investigation name?
He took it to one of the assistant U.S. attorneys on the case, who rejected the notion out of hand, leaving no opening for debate. The soccer case would have no name.
What a buzzkill, this unnamed AUSA.
Seriously. I think it was like the IRS guy was from California. The AUSA is New York. Clash of cultures.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What else could we have named it? Operation shot out for a throw-in?
Operation it is not possible.
That's good. That's good, too.
Really good.
Yeah. All right. Let's stick with Operation Own Goal for our purposes today. Stefan, what is your Operation Own Goal?
Well, I just wanted to get you up to date on my vacation plans, Josh, for the summer. We're going to Iceland next month, doing the full loop of the island, glaciers, waterfalls, volcanoes.
I already knew that, but should I perform surprise?
Sure.
Wow.
Some surprise.
Yeah. That's great.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
But while we were picking the travel dates, I didn't look at the World Cup schedule. So we won't be in Iceland during group play, when we would have been guaranteed to see dentist/coach Heimir Hallgrímsson's first-time World Cup qualifiers play. The team got off to a pretty good start without me being in Iceland. That 1-1 tie with Argentina, thanks to Lionel Messi's missed penalty and Iceland's indomitable Viking spirit. If they can beat Nigeria, get a point off of Croatia, and Argentina can beat Croatia, all of which is doable, Iceland would be through to the knockout round. But I still won't be able to watch Iceland on their home soil with all those happy Icelanders in the round of 16 or the quarterfinals. So I'm counting on them to make it to the semifinals at least, so that I can have the most exciting vacationing foreigner viewing experience possible. This is really about me soaking up that local culture during the World Cup. Can't argue with
that. How far did they make it in the Euros?
Quarters.
So they would need to get one step further. They made it to the gold medal game in handball.
That's right.
Yeah.
They won the silver.
So they need to just imbibe the spirit of the Icelandic national
team. I think they are fully capable of doing this. But I'm also steeling myself, Josh, for the possibility that all those Gudmundsons and Sigurdsons will bow out valiantly before the semifinals. That doesn't mean I'm not going to watch the games, though. I need to watch the games. So I'm planning now for how to do that. I told Clara at Nordic Visitor, who was filling in for Thor, who helped us plan our trip, I told Clara about my plight and asked her for some suggestions for where to watch the semifinals and finals. Clara and the internet were very helpful. So on the day of the first semifinal, July 10th, we're going to be in Hvolsvellir in southern Iceland. I think I said that pretty well.
There's a Buffalo Wild Wings there, right?
There isn't. Population 900. Clara says that Café Selfos in our hotel will most likely broadcast the game, but I need a backup. And Gamla Fjósið, I totally butchered that, looks really promising. That means old cowhouse.
It doesn't mean Buffalo Wild Wings.
Close. Old cowhouse. Old cowhouse sounds really good, though. It's right below that volcanic glacier that erupted back in 2010.
Yeah.
And if you're listening, old cowhouse, mark me down for the volcano soup, which the menu describes as a powerful, hearty meat soup. I'm looking forward to the party.
Jalapeno poppers from the spirit world.
All right, for the second semifinal on July 11th, we're going to be in a town that I'm not even going to try to pronounce, but here are some possibilities.
Kirkjubæjarklaustur. Kirkjubæjarklaustur.
I think the last one sounds most plausible.
Sure.
Don't you think?
Yeah.
All right. Clara says this could be tricky in that place. There really isn't any sports bar, she emailed me. My best guess is that the games will either be broadcasted at the gas station located in the village or at the Icelandair Hotel Klaustur. I need to follow up with Clara because there seem to be two gas stations there, the OB and the N1, and I don't know which one might be broadcasting the game.
Seems like you should just go to somebody's house.
Could do that too.
Yeah, just knock on the door.
Yeah, the gas station sounds pretty great though.
Yeah.
That could be fun.
Could be.
Yeah. Clara also didn't mention the restaurant Sistra Coffee, which looks promising too. Our menu offers a wide variety of food, from pizzas and burgers to succulent steaks and fresh fish. Everyone should be able to find something that they like and to leave both full and happy. The final is on July 15, and by then we'll be way up in northern Iceland. We're going to miss the Arctic Open Golf Tournament, which is later this week. And we're also going to miss Pancake Day, Pancake Day Festival. It's a big event up there.
A lot of poor planning on this trip.
I know. The World Cup final is going to be competing with motorcycle days, so poor planning on the part of FIFA, if you ask me. That's organized by the Motorbike Club Tian. It offers a diverse programming to suit all those who have a passion for motorbikes. It's going to siphon away a lot of people from the World Cup final. Clara says our hotel will be showing the game. If not, she recommends asking the hotel staff where we can go. The locals are very friendly and will help you find a place where you can watch the game. It is going to be awesome, Josh, to be among the locals in Laugarbaki when Iceland hoists the World Cup trophy. I will be thunderclapping through the endless day there.
Enjoy your part-time dentistry. That's going to be fun.
Thanks. Josh, what's your Operation Own Goal?
So NBA draft coming up this week.
Very excited.
Last week, in even more exciting news, ESPN reported that the one-and-done rule could be gone from the NBA as soon as 2021, once again allowing the nation's best high school basketball players to go straight to the pros, just like LeBron James, Kobe Bryant, and Ndubi Ebi once did. Daryl Dawkins and Bill Willoughby are often thought of as the first guys to go prep to pro, with both getting picked in the 1975 draft, 2 decades before Kevin Garnett restarted the trend in 1995. There's a guy who came 13 years before Dawkins and Willoughby, though. His name is Reggie Harding. He was taken with the 29th pick in the fourth round of the 62 draft by the Detroit Pistons. Harding was 19 years old. He was a seven-footer. He got picked out of Detroit Eastern High School, where he'd won 3 straight city titles. He was deemed ineligible to play in the NBA. And looking back at some of the contemporaneous reporting, nobody really explains it. They basically just say the league's board of governors decided to make a special ruling because he was coming straight out of high school just to postpone his entry to the league. They just didn't want him to, they wanted him to sit out for a year. Sounds kind of familiar. The following year, UPI reported that the NBA failed to approve Harding's contract for a few months after he was arrested for having a gun in a Detroit bar and was charged with car theft, breaking and entering at a recreation building, and, quote, a morals offense. When Harding did finally make it to the NBA, he averaged 11 points and 10.5 rebounds per game at the age of 21 in 1963-64, and 12 points and 11.6 rebounds the next year. He would lose his spot in the NBA again in 1965, with the Akron Beacon Journal reporting that the following headlines had been written about Harding. Reg guilty of assault. Harding granted new trial. Reggie Harding arrested in break-in. Harding put on probation. Judge dismisses charges on Reggie. Reggie arrested for reckless driving. Harding accused as, quote, gunslinger. All-city cager held in theft. Pistons won't take Reggie back. A few years later, Harding ended up with the Indiana Pacers in the ABA. In his oral history of the league, Loose Balls, Terry Pluto quotes the Pacers general manager Mike Storin as saying with regard to Harding, he wouldn't go to practice, he was late for team flights. Once he said that he had to leave the team to go to his daughter's funeral, which we fell for hook, line, and sinker. Of course, he did not have a daughter. According to Storin, he also once held a gun to his teammate Jim Tweety Bird Rail's head in the middle of the night, saying, Tweety Bird, I hear you hate, and then a racial slur. Rail got Harding to give him the gun. Then a few minutes later, he woke up to find Harding holding the gun to his head again. Storin also claimed that Harding once said in a TV interview, if I had a gun, I'd shoot Mike Storin. The Pacers were the last pro basketball team Harding ever played for. In 1972, he was 30 years old and trying to overcome a years-long addiction to heroin. In September of that year, a friend of Harding's named Carl Scott slapped Harding twice in the face, which led Harding to slap him back. Scott came back with a gun and shot Harding in the head, killing him. Before he died, Harding reportedly said, why, Man, You Shot Me. A two-part Detroit Free Press series published after his death illustrated Harding's extremely difficult upbringing, how he was sensitive about being given up for adoption, and how the early criminal charges against him were overblown. His wife told the newspaper, "He hated authority. It's deep in his childhood. That's all I could tell about it. If the Pistons would tell him to wear a shirt and tie, he would show up in a turtleneck. It was more than that, too. All those other guys had been to college, and Reggie kept harping on that they thought they were better than he was. After the games, he would cry sometimes and say, 'I just don't belong.' And he would go back to the pool hall with the guys and stay out all night with them. They were the guys he grew up with. He felt he was going to the top, and he would take them with him." But that storyline omits some important information about Reggie Harding. In his 2009 biography of the Supremes' Florence Ballard, Peter Benjaminson reported that Harding had allegedly raped Ballard at knife point after a sock hop in 1960, the same year the 18-year-old Harding would be arrested on morals charges for having sex with a 15-year-old. Ballard's fellow Supreme, Mary Wilson, would say that the rape ate away at Flo's insides. She couldn't handle it. She needed professional help, but never got it. Ballard would become an alcoholic, and she'd die of cardiac arrest in 1976. The character of Effie White in Dreamgirls was based on Ballard's life. Jennifer Hudson, who won an Oscar for playing that role, said in an interview when the movie came out, "Florence's story was actually good news for me because it made me angry. I really felt like Effie was Florence's voice, and this was her fans' way of getting her justice, or having it end the way they would have liked to see it end."
Wow. I mean, the connections there are kind of crazy.
Yeah, the Free Press series, which if people have newspapers.com, which is, I think, my favorite website and Stefan's favorite website, it's really, really in-depth for a newspaper series. Just in kind of doing archival research from the 70s, you rarely see that kind of magazine-like journalism. It has a lot of details about Harding's life and death. But as I said at the end, even, you know, that kind of comprehensive story left out a really important piece that only came out after Harding died and after Florence Ballard died. That is our show for today. Our producer is Patrick Fort. To listen to past shows and subscribe or just reach out, go to slate.com/hangup. You can email us at hangup@slate.com. For Stefan Fatsis, I'm Josh Levine. Remember Zelmo Beatty, and thanks for listening.